True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
So something a little different today, Dick. We're going back to the 80s and a really amazing crime that happened. So this occurred in a high-rise LA office building in 1988. And at the center of these events was a detective from New York named John McClain. He and his wife Holly were separated at the time over some issues, including her blossoming career with the Nakatomi Corporation in LA. But John visited her for the holidays that year, and he soon found himself at the center of a complex and violent robbery plot. So the events that follow are quite shocking, and they do show some failures by the LAPD to rescue hostages or arrest the perpetrators. In fact, if not for a beat cop named Al Powell, John McClain would have been completely on his own against these terrible criminals. So join us at the quiet end for Die Hard, the story of two good cops who prevailed over evil on Christmas Eve of 1988.
You might be amazed to find out that I got a beer for this.
No, I expect that.
So I have a beer called Nakatomi Plaza Chocolate Peppermint Porter. It's probably a one-off on this beer because I haven't been able to find any evidence of it for the past several years. But we got an early one. So it's a porter, and the title pretty much says it all. You can sense some chocolate. There's some peppermint, although it's light, which is fortunate because you kind of mess it up, I think. And taste is the same, very heavy on the chocolate, a little bit of alcohol, and some peppermint. Pretty nice beer, actually.
All right, why don't we open that up?
Okay.
All right, Dickie, I want you to come down to the quiet end and meet me under the mistletoe.
Okay. I know what that means.
Yeah. It's your lucky day.
Yeah. I love those days.
So before we get into the details of this crime, I think we should go over the backgrounds of some of the main characters.
That's always a good idea. So Holly Gennaro was born in 1956 in Cornwall, Connecticut. Her parents were quite well off. Her mother was a physician, and her father was the district attorney for Litchfield County. Holly was the oldest of four children and the only female. She had a happy childhood, playing sports and excelling at her Catholic girls-only school. In high school, Holly was a top student. Then following graduation, she went to the NYU School of Business with plans to work as a corporate executive. But Holly would meet her future husband, John McClain, in New York, and her plans changed. At least for a time.
So John McClain was born in 1955, and he was raised in Brooklyn with his younger brother Mark. His father, a New York firefighter, died when John was only 12. And his mom, Gwen, had to take a pay cut at her job with City Hall so she could be home more with her boys. When John was 13, he took his first job delivering groceries on his bicycle. One day, while out making a delivery, John witnessed a carjacking where the driver was shot to death, and this really made an impression on him.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was very traumatic, but it also made him decide that he wanted to be a New York City police officer when he grew up. So John met Holly at NYU when she was 19 and he was 20. Holly was an honor student, and John was working at the college as a janitor while he took classes in criminal justice at the nearby community college. Now, the way they met was pretty cute, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, I guess. I'll grant it that.
Okay.
It's kind of cute. Not the way I would have gone about it.
Well, he was a 20-year-old kid, right?
Right.
So he caught Holly's eye, and she made it a point to eat her meals in the cafeteria while she knew John would be working cleaning the floors. She couldn't get up the nerve to talk to him, so she ended up writing him a note on an ice cream sandwich wrapper, and she left it on top of his cleaning cart. On the note, Holly wrote down the address of a frat party she was planning to attend that weekend, and below the address she wrote, "Please come to a party at this address on Saturday night. I think you're cute." And John knew who it was. He had his eye on Holly as well.
Oh, yeah, he definitely did. And when he read the note, he laughed, and he was wondering if that cute girl with the long dark curls had written it, although he was pretty sure she had. He had noticed her looking at him, and they had shared a smile a couple of times. But to John, he was thinking that Holly was pretty much out of his league. But no way he's going to miss a party. So he went right out to the local Salvation Army's thrift store, bought himself a new shirt to wear. Then as soon as he arrived at the party that Saturday, he saw Holly standing in the kitchen, looking pretty good. He gathered up his courage and walked over to her, introduced himself. Holly said, "I'm glad you came."
And she was kind of forward for a 19-year-old.
I guess so.
But, you know, Holly's a very strong woman, and you can see that through this whole trauma she went through, that she was really strong and kind of a leader among her coworkers. She handed John a beer, and they spent that entire evening talking. When John got home late that night, he told his brother Mark that he had met the girl he planned to marry. And he swears that's true.
Well, who's to say?
So it did take some time to win over Holly's parents, as you can imagine. But they grew to love John like a son. He was a very hard worker, and he entered the police academy just 2 weeks before their wedding. So these are two young kids with some big plans.
Yeah, they were kind of young to get married.
They were, but it did last, even though it did have its ups and downs.
A few bumps in the road there. So they had two children, a boy and a girl. John was promoted to homicide detective after being a street cop for 5 years. Holly worked for Macy's in corporate, but then took a couple years off to have her kids. Once the children were both in school, Holly went back to work. John was a devoted detective, and is probably away from home too much.
Well, you know, he took his job very seriously. I mean, he would give his life for this job if he had to. He wasn't afraid. There was nothing too scary for him.
No, and he always wanted to see things through.
Absolutely. Yep, just very tough.
So one day in the summer of 1988, Holly was offered a VP job in Los Angeles. And she discussed it with John, but he was kind of dismissive, you know, like, "Oh, why do you want to go out there? You got a good job here," you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think he also kind of liked to be the breadwinner in the house.
Well, she worked.
Yeah, but he was the one working full time.
Yeah.
And I think he was a little intimidated, you know, by her line of work, because she would make more money than him when she was working full time.
That's right. So after weeks of arguments about this job, Holly took it. She and the children moved to L.A., and she wanted John to come along with them, but his pride or whatever, he was too stubborn. He didn't go. He figured Holly would miss him and would return to New York. But she was doing very well in her job with the Nakatomi Corporation, and their return to New York was getting less and less likely.
Yeah, so I imagine at this time he really missed his family. By that December, John was beginning to soften. He agreed to visit over the holidays, and he arrived in L.A. on December 24th. He arrived just in time for Holly's corporate Christmas party. Now, John was a guy who did not like to fly. He was very nervous on his flight to L.A. His seatmate noticed his discomfort and told him to take time to make fists with his feet on the carpet once he reached his destination. The seatmate said this would be a cure for his jet lag.
I'll have to try that sometime.
Yeah, but I don't think jet lag was his main concern. He was more afraid of crashing.
He didn't like to fly.
No, made him nervous.
So after he landed, he picked up his luggage, and he approached a chauffeur driver who was holding a sign with his name on it. The driver was a young guy named Argyle, and he took him to the Nakatomi Plaza to meet Holly. John and Argyle kind of bonded a little on the way over, and Argyle agreed to wait for him in the parking garage.
Yeah, these guys really hit it off. John had this big stuffed bear, I guess, for his child, and Argyle thought that was really cute. But then he started asking him questions about his marriage, and Argyle was very perceptive. John told him about his wife taking the job in L.A., and Argyle said right away, "Well, you thought she'd just come crawling back to you, didn't you?" And John laughed at that. He said, "You've got me figured out."
He did.
So John arrived at the building early in the evening, just as employees were finishing up work and preparing for the party. He was greeted by the security guard and he learned that Holly was working under her maiden name, Gennaro. So John was kind of old-fashioned. This annoyed him. Annoyed him quite a bit, more than he would admit.
Yeah, it really did. He was kind of pissed.
Yeah, but then he seemed to accept it. And as he was making his way to the elevators, just because he's been a detective for a while, he was just looking over the place, kind of sizing up everything. Probably routine for someone who's been a homicide detective.
Well, I imagine any place he goes, he's going to be kind of casing the place out.
Oh, absolutely. And when he finally did see Holly, things were a little tense. But he did seem to start realizing that he'd been a jerk. So as he was washing up in Holly's office bathroom, she had a fancy office, her own bathroom, a big desk. She was doing well. Holly went ahead to the party, where her fellow employees were waiting for her.
Meanwhile, a Mercedes sedan pulled up to the Nakatomi Plaza entrance, with a truck behind him that pulled into the parking garage. These are a group of thieves posing as terrorists. Two of them, Carl and Theo, walk into the building, talking about a basketball game. Carl kills the guard by shooting him in the head.
Yeah, this was just a brutal killing from all I've heard.
Yeah.
Just not a second thought, really.
Stroll in, boom. Theo was the IT guy for the bunch. Theo hopped over the security desk and began using the computer to shut off all the elevators but one and seal off the parking garage exits.
Yeah, so this is a very organized, planned-out robbery, obviously.
Very well, almost military in its precision.
Yeah, and how many guys were involved in this?
Geez, about a dozen.
Yeah, and I guess not all of them from Europe, but it seems like the majority were from Germany.
Yes, there was a lot of German being spoken.
Yes, but it seems like the IT guy was American.
Yeah. In the garage, the leader of the terrorists, Hans Gruber, exited the back of the truck. He used a chainsaw to cut through all the phone lines. And cell phones just weren't around, so all communication to the building was done.
Yeah. Boom. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Hans. I know you did a little background research on him, because now he's kind of a legend to the criminal types.
He sure is. Now, he was born in 1938 in Hamburg, Germany. His mother was a sex worker, and his father was an officer in the Luftwaffe.
Whoa, those are some beginnings.
I tell you. Shortly after he was born, his mother left him on the steps of a church, and he was found there by the choir master. He was placed in a local orphanage called a Waisenhaus in Germany, where he remained until he was a year old. And at that age, he was adopted by Carl and Sophia Gruber. Carl owned a small tobacco store in Hamburg, and Sophia was a housewife. They were childless.
But they were, like, nice people as far as we could tell, right?
Yeah, they were wonderful people.
Yeah, so it's not like he had this horrible childhood. He was born to a sex worker and a Nazi, but he was able to get adopted by this nice couple at a very young age. He was still only a one-year-old. So there had to be something genetically evil about Hans.
Must have been. Because he did pretty well with the Grubers.
As far as we know, I mean, little is known of Hans' early life with the Grubers, but we know he completed elementary school and high school and attended Heidelberg University.
Yeah, but he didn't graduate from Heidelberg. He ended up being expelled in his senior year after a series of thefts on the campus. Now, he was never prosecuted for the thefts, and this might have made him more bold because he embarked on a life of crime. That was his chosen profession.
Sure. But also, a lot of the girls in high school, the ones who had dated him or even been around him, said that he did not treat women well. Right? He was really rude to them, on the verge of abusive. Definitely treated them as sex objects.
Oh, sure. That's Hans.
That was Hans, yes.
Now, from some humble beginnings, at least in terms of the value of the goods stolen, Hans and his gang, Der Adler, which is the eagle in English. I don't know how they came up with that name. But they quickly became notorious throughout Europe. For over 20 years, they had been responsible for the theft of over $30 million in cash paintings and securities.
Wow, that was a lot of stuff.
They were big time, and they managed to get uncaught.
Well, and they did steal all these things, but also people did end up getting hurt and killed.
Yeah, they were felt to be responsible for at least 10 deaths. But then over the course of the last year or so, there hadn't been any sign of Hans or Der Adler, and many people were led to wonder if he was dead, or maybe he was planning another robbery, something bigger, in fact.
Right, and so we know now that he was planning on robbing the Nakatomi Plaza because they had a large amount of bearer bonds. But when they first arrived at the building, people thought they were terrorists, and they did try and kind of pull themselves off that way, present themselves that way.
Yeah, they did.
So John was still upstairs in Holly's office, and he tried the fists with his toes in the carpet and was pretty surprised to see it seemed to be working. He felt a little better. He picked up the phone to call Argyle in the limo, but the line was dead. We know why, right?
Yes, we do.
Hans and his group were in the building at this point, and they entered the vestibule where the party had begun. Several of them fired into the ceiling to get everyone's attention and, of course, intimidate and frighten them. John heard the gunshots, and of course he knew what they were immediately, and he ran into a stairwell. Fortunately, he did have his police-issued handgun with him, but he was barefoot, and that could make things tough for him later on.
Certainly did. Now, he almost exited the stairwell on a floor, but he saw some of the terrorists right there. So he went up another flight or two, exited onto a floor that was still under construction. So he's kind of freaked, you know, this gang taking over the building.
And I think most people would just find a place to hide.
Yes.
I would.
Not John.
I'd just find a place to hide and cry. But, you know, for one thing, his wife is down there. And for another thing, he's kind of the type who wanted to be a hero and save people. That was kind of how he looked at himself. His
yes.
identity was wound up in that. He was more than just a policeman by trade. He was a policeman in his heart.
He was. So he's trying to come up with some semblance of a plan.
Yeah.
And not having too much success just yet.
No, but he's thinking things through. And back at the party, Hans told the employees that he was going to teach the Nakatomi Corporation a lesson on the real use of power, because they have a history of greed. And then he did single out the company owner, Joe Takagi. Hans and his co-conspirators took Takagi into a boardroom to try and get codes from him for the company's vault. He didn't even know the codes, though, so Hans ended up killing him. He was killed with a gunshot to the head, and his body wouldn't be found until days later when they were going through a lot of the rubble from this horrible episode. But John overheard this, and he realized, hey, these are bad guys. They are not going to hesitate to kill anyone. And they were there to steal $640 million in bearer bonds, not caring at all who they killed along the way. But John did actually accidentally make a noise as he was leaving that area and had to take off. But fortunately, the terrorists didn't see him at that point. So he was still hoping that maybe his driver, Argyle, had heard the shots and that he would call the police. But Argyle was in the limo, blaring music and talking to his girlfriend. He was like, what, 21, 22 years old at that point?
Yeah, just a kid.
He was. I mean, at this point, Argyle is famous, right? Because he has become a producer for a lot of rappers, having a big corporation that he has built.
Yeah, good. So John went back to an upper floor, and he decides to pull a fire alarm. He's figuring that'll get the authorities there. And he even saw the fire engines coming down the street. But then they turned around.
Oh, and just what a sight, huh? You're getting all excited. You think that help is on the way.
Yeah.
And then they turn around and turn their sirens off. I guess what happened was Hans had already contacted 911 and told them that this was a false alarm. He must have gotten the magic word or code or whatever it is you need to tell them, right?
Or he must have done something, because otherwise they're not stopping.
Right. But remember, they took a good year planning this, so they knew what they were doing. But as John was looking out the window thinking, what the hell am I going to do now? One of the terrorists named Tony showed up with a gun. And John would end up in a fight with Tony. But Tony ended up falling down a stairwell and died there of a broken neck.
Yeah, so John went down the stairs, took Tony's two-way radio, a lighter, and a machine gun off the body. Then he tied Tony's body onto a desk chair, put a Santa hat on him, and sent him down to the party in the elevator. So he gets there, the elevator door is open, and when people see his body, they see that John had written on the sweatshirt, "Now I have a machine gun. ho, ho, ho. And John was kind of clever about this. He rode down on top of the elevator. So he was able to listen to the terrorists, and he wrote down their names on his arm. And then he rode the elevator to the top floor and escaped to the roof.
Yeah, so how do you feel about this, Dick? I mean, it doesn't seem very professional or kind to do that. Yes, it was a bad guy, but it's still a human being who's perished. So he's kind of making a joke of this man by putting him in the chair with a Santa hat and writing ho, ho, ho. So he really got a lot of criticism for that.
He did, but you know, I think he was trying to goad the group, or at least Hans, into doing something or making a mistake. He was needling them.
Oh, absolutely, he was. Yeah, it's just, it was frowned upon by many people.
Well, I mean, John's a cowboy.
Exactly. And he did end up doing some good, so it's definitely forgiven. But not by Tony's brother, Carl, who was also in the gang.
Yeah, he was pissed.
Yeah, and Carl was huge, big blonde guy. Especially angry with John interfering, and he wanted to kill him right off. And Hans said, sure, you can kill him, but first we need to finish this job of getting into the safe. So first things first. And Hans was in charge, so Carl listened at this point. So what John did at this point is he went up to the roof and used the two-way radio that he'd taken off of Tony to try and call for help. The operator that he reached thought this was a prank. But then she did hear the gunshots, and these were machine guns. So she decided to send an LAPD officer to the plaza to check it out. And the officer called to respond was a middle-aged guy named Al Powell. Al was actually at a convenience store when he got the call. He was buying Twinkies, he said, for his pregnant wife. But Al was on the chubby side, so I bet he would have one or two himself.
Well, he's going to be a nice guy, and he's going to test them first to make sure they're okay.
That's very kind. Now, Al had a history, and he was kind of a desk jockey at this point. He would go out on patrol, but he wasn't really involved in fighting crime because of things he'd been through. And we'll get into that. Can you tell me what you know about that?
Well, I know that he shot a kid accidentally. He stopped a kid, a 13-year-old, a young teenager.
Yes.
And the kid had a toy gun. Obviously, if you're a cop and it's dark out, you can't tell a toy from a real gun. So he shot the kid and killed him. And this made him feel pretty shitty, right?
Oh, terribly guilty, terribly.
He wasn't even sure if he wanted to continue working as a policeman.
Well, that's completely understandable. And the uproar in Los Angeles after this happened was really tough on him.
Oh, yeah.
Because Al's an African-American guy. And I really don't think there was race involved in this at all, but the 13-year-old was African-American as well. And, you know, the police have a bad track record with things like this. So Al became the subject of a lot of abuse and criticism for quite a while. Even though he was found not to be guilty of doing anything wrong, he certainly felt guilty. That would never totally go away.
No, it sure wouldn't.
So back on the roof, John was evading gunfire, and then he entered a closeted area with a big ventilation fan. So this was just amazing that he blocked this fan by propping a machine gun inside of it. Then he was able to climb through between the fan blades, which I imagine would be scary because if that gun got pushed out, you'd get chopped to smithereens.
He'd be mincemeat.
Yeah. But he was pretty much cornered in the elevator shaft, and another amazing thing he did is he wedged the machine gun into an opening into the shaft and tried to climb down, holding onto the gun strap. So this was kind of like a window, a little bit bigger than you'd need for a person to get through in the shaft. And it's just amazing. I mean, it's almost like something you'd see in an action film.
Yeah, I mean, it's in that kind of unbelievable category.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
But he managed. And he got down the elevator shaft and got into a horizontal vent. Then once he's in the vent, he used the lighter that he took from Tony as his light source. Carl, remember, he's gunning for him.
Yes.
He saw the light, and he began shooting into the vent. But just as he's working his way down to where John is crawling, he's called away.
Yeah, thankfully for that, huh?
Yeah, John was going to be a dead goose.
Well, yeah, when he was crawling through that horizontal vent, I just can't imagine what was going through his head. probably, you know, something like he was planning on going out to the coast, you know, going to a party, having a few laughs. But that's not what happened.
Yes, when John got out of the vent, he walked over to the windows and sees Al pulling up in the police car. Al went inside, but the criminal sitting at the front desk fooled him into believing he was the security guard.
Yeah, this criminal was Eddie Walker. So Al just thought that was the security guard, of course. He left the building, got back into his patrol car. But then as Al was beginning to pull away, John was looking out the window saying, you know, what the hell? We finally have a policeman here, and now he's leaving. So he was able to break through one of the glass windows, or they're actually more like walls, right, of the high-rise.
Yep.
And he was able to throw another one of the gang members who he had killed, and this was Marco, out of a window. Now, this is just miraculous as well. I mean, luck was really on John's side this night, because Marco's body landed right on the hood of the police officer Al's car. I mean, what are the odds on that?
Those must be pretty slim.
Right, but because you're way up there, you're throwing a body out. There's no way to tell where it's going to land.
Yeah, but that definitely got Al's attention.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, and then as the body comes flying out and hits his car, there's gunshots fired at Al's car by the terrorists. And Al's trying to back up. He's pretty much spooked out of his mind.
Well, Al had had kind of a quiet life lately.
Then his car went over a retaining wall. Al got out okay. But he's thinking, what the hell is going on here?
Pretty shocking, because everything had looked fine when he went into the building. But, you know, he had actually come close to being killed. If he'd noticed anything, they would not have hesitated to kill him. We know that.
Definitely.
But then he did call for backup, and as backup arrived at the building, John was harassing Hans over the radio. So I think you're right. I think he was really trying to needle him.
Oh, yeah, no question. So Hans insulted John as an American who grew up watching way too many cowboy TV shows. And then John told him, well, Roy Rogers was my favorite. And he signed off his conversation with Hans by saying, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yeah, and John would become kind of famous for that.
Yeah, it's one of his catchphrases, isn't it?
I think so. I think he said it when he's handled other crimes since then.
Yeah.
But this was something he definitely would be remembered for, along with being a real hero. Let's just say it outright, just a hero.
He was.
He was not going to die easily. So Al radioed John, and John told him what was going on. And these two were having a good conversation. They're both policemen. They're bonding. When the police chief showed up, he was kind of a dick, though. He gave Al a hard time, and Al and John began to bond over this situation. Why are we dealing with such idiots? Why won't the police chief believe what Al's saying? But he treated Al very poorly. And he would be called to task on that later on when all of this was gone over by the board of policemen.
Yeah, neither he nor the FBI came out looking very good.
No, no. But like I said, Holly was a real leader. So she was down at the foyer, or what would you call that area?
Oh, the big entryway.
Yeah. On that floor, though. It wasn't on the first floor.
No.
No. So she went to speak to Hans. He was in one of the offices. And she asked for people to be taken to the bathroom because time's passing and people need to go. And she also asked for a couch for her pregnant secretary. And surprisingly, Hans was okay with that. I guess if he was extremely evil, he could have just shot them all dead. If he was like his biological father, the Nazi, for certain.
Well, maybe he figured he still might need to use one of them for something.
Well, sure, but there were a lot of them.
But yeah, he could have just killed them all, gotten into the vault and taken off.
Yeah, but she was using the name Gennaro, which was kind of good, so Hans wouldn't be able to figure out that John was her husband if he found out who John was, which I think he eventually did. But meanwhile, the police had brought in a SWAT team. And the SWAT team was immediately hit by the terrorists' heavy artillery. They had these big lights, and the terrorists just shot those lights out like it was nothing. And at this point, Al's kind of just rolling his eyes, because he's just a beat cop, but he knows better.
Well, he knows that things aren't going the way they should be going.
Exactly. Then Hans ordered his men to blow up the SWAT team's tank with a rocket launcher, so they came prepared.
They were very prepared.
So John had found some C4 and some other things, explosive things.
Yeah, that plastic explosive, the C4.
Yeah.
And he found that in a terrorist bag. He threw that down the elevator shaft, and when it exploded, two more terrorists were killed. He found the explosives and detonators, which made him think that Hans was planning to blow something up, although he wasn't for sure about it. Totally.
Yeah, right. But I think he was. I think it would turn out that that's what he planned to do, and he probably planned that he'd just let everyone get killed there. You know, he might take a few for hostages, but other than that...
Yeah.
The police chief took the radio away from Al, but John insulted the police chief and told him, hey, put Al back on. So that was the end of that.
That was it.
And he didn't tell Al his real name. He told Al to call him Roy, like Roy Rogers, his favorite cowboy.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a co-worker of Holly's whose name was Harry. And he was a bit of an ass, not wanting to speak ill of the dead, but he was. Harry had a cocaine issue at the time, so that might have contributed to his demise.
Well, yeah, he's a corporate guy in the 80s. I think he's almost a cliche.
Oh, it's definitely.
Yeah.
Anyway, he found out from Holly that John was the one pissing off Hans, and it was interfering with the plans of the gang. So good old Harry snorted some coke and said, I'm going to take care of this. He went into Takagi's office to negotiate with Hans.
Yikes.
But Harry is not realizing what a dangerous guy Hans is.
No, not at all.
So he told Hans John's name and contacted John on the handheld radio. Harry pretended to be John's friend. But John realized that this was a bad idea, and he tried to explain to Hans that he barely knew Harry. But Hans said John needed to return his detonators or Harry would be killed.
Yes.
Now, he knew he couldn't do that, or he and everyone else are going to get killed, as well as Harry. And that's what happened. Hans just shot Harry dead. Boom.
No hesitation. No, just like he had shot Takagi.
Then the FBI arrived, and Al tried to fill them in on what was happening to the building. But the FBI guys were coming across also as kind of dickheaded.
Dickheaded, I like that.
Al refused to leave. He was invited to leave by the police officer.
Yeah, he said, you couldn't drag me away or something like that, is what he'd said in interviews since then.
Yeah, I mean, he said he was feeling some sort of alliance with John.
Sure.
And he knew that John was trying to save everyone. However, the FBI and the police chief were just dismissing John as someone who was getting in the way.
Well, yeah, that for certain, and maybe even saying he could be in on it.
Right.
Which Al was offended by because he really felt like John was going out of his way, risking his own life to try and help here.
Yeah, and he had not an idea that John, from his actions, was a cop.
Sure. Yes.
So Hans was pretending to terrorize people in order to get his fellow freedom fighters released from prisons around the world. Then he also demanded a helicopter to take him and the hostages to the airport.
So soon after that, Hans went to the mechanical room and he inspected the explosives. John found him, but Hans was clever and he pretended to be an employee from the party. According to what John would say later, Hans had a pretty good American accent, but there were some things that were just a little off, so he was certainly suspicious of this man. Although Hans was clever enough to use the name of an employee from the company directory. So when John said, what's your name? He said that name and it made him a little more believable. But John was smart. He didn't fully buy this. So he gave Hans a gun, but he didn't put any bullets in it, just in case he was one of the terrorists. Because remember, he'd heard them, but he hadn't really seen Hans yet.
Right. He didn't know what he looked like.
But of course, Hans, being the bad guy that he was, turned the gun on John. But it didn't fire, and he was surprised. Uh-oh.
Yeah, John outsmarted him.
Yes, but before John had a chance to shoot Hans or even restrain him, three more of the gang members showed up and started opening fire on him. So he ran away as the terrorists were shooting out all the glass doors in the offices, and he had to run across a lot of broken glass in bare feet, cutting the hell out of his feet.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think he knew this might become a problem, and when he killed the first gang member, he tried to take his shoes, but they were too small. Way too small. He couldn't wear them.
Way too small.
Yeah. But in the rush to escape, he had to leave the bag with the detonators behind. And at that point, Hans was getting very angry. He was really sick of this. Things just were not going as planned, and John McClane was causing problems for him. So the FBI decided they would shut off all the power to the building.
Yeah, but this played right into their hands.
It certainly did.
Because when they did that, the locks on the safe disengaged because there was no electricity.
Making things easier, yeah.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, John was in a bathroom taking pieces of glass out of his feet, covered in blood. And he was talking to Al on the radio, and they were kind of bonding. They're both family men, both police officers. And John was starting to feel now like he wasn't going to make it. What are the odds he's going to get out of this alive? So he asked Al to say goodbye to his wife, Holly. And Al told him, no, you're going to make it out, buddy, and you're going to see her again and tell her yourself. So very supportive. These two men really had a good relationship.
Yeah, then this TV reporter, he figured out who John was. And he went to Holly's home to interview the nanny and the children. Hans is watching this impromptu interview, and he recognized the kids from the photo in Holly's office.
Yeah, so this reporter, Thornburg, was a real dick, too.
Yeah, there's a bunch of dicks here.
It's very dicky.
Yep.
Because he went to the house, to Holly's house, where there are these little children. How old were their kids at this time? 4 and 8 or something like that?
I don't know, 5 and 6.
Little kids. But he threatened the nanny that he would call the police and have her deported.
Yep.
He'd call ICE she didn't let him in to talk to the kids.
Yeah, so what's she going to do?
Yeah, she really didn't want to, but she was afraid. He was intimidating. But having that on TV was really bad for John and what he was trying to do.
Absolutely.
So now Hans recognized the children, and he knows. He picks up a picture. He sees Holly with John. Now he knows what John looks like, of course, because of that earlier encounter. So he took Holly with him as a hostage to the vault, and he ordered the rest of the hostages to get up to the roof. Now, during this time, John got into a big fight with Carl, the brother of the first terrorist he had killed. And Carl was determined that he was going to kill John for killing his brother. And after just a brutal fight, like a fight to the death, Carl was left hanging by a chain in this big area.
Yep. John somehow got the best of him.
Which is really another miraculous thing, because Carl was huge. And John was kind of an average-sized guy.
Carl wasn't that huge.
I think they said he was 6'2", 6'3".
You know, before he became a criminal.
Yeah.
He was a famous dancer in the Russian ballet.
Which is just hard to believe also, because I think of people who dance as being more gentle. Well, you know, he did have that injury, right, that interfered with his dancing career. So maybe he had some resentments.
Possibly. John's searching for Holly in this crowd of people. But Ginny tells him that Hans took Holly with him. So he tried to warn the police, John did, not to land the helicopter on the roof because there were explosives up there. He fired one of the terrorist guns into the air. The FBI agents in the helicopter fired back at him. They thought he was one of the terrorists.
Yeah, and it's just funny. When John was on Oprah a couple years after this, he was telling her how it was really a stupid decision, right, to fire that machine gun above the heads of the hostages. Of course, the FBI in the helicopter thought he was one of them.
Well, certainly.
So, yeah, he even admitted that was not a smart idea. But he was able to get to one edge of the roof. He didn't get hit by a bullet, miraculously. And actually, he used a fire hose. He tied it around his waist, and he was going to rappel himself down the building. Now, this is just crazy.
Yeah, this is... You're talking about sneaking through that fan and using the machine gun as a strap and everything. This is even more unlikely, but somehow it worked.
Well, I mean, kind of. The hose was connected to a big heavy metal wheel, and he tied himself around it and kind of had to jump off the building or be shot. Those were his choices.
Yeah.
But then, once he's off there, of course, it's only going to let him down a couple floors. It's not that long. And he's just hanging there off the building. And he said he started swinging back and forth, kicking the glass with his bloody feet, which were kind of like nubs at this point. They were so damaged. And he's really lucky that he didn't lose a toe or something.
He definitely was.
But then, and this might be the most amazing thing that John McClane did that night, he shot the glass and then swung himself on the fire hose and got into that floor.
Just as the wheel came down.
Well, then the wheel came down, and I guess the wheel tried to drag him out because it was heavier than he was. But somehow he managed to untie himself, and he didn't fall out. But he said, you know, he was really thought he was dead at that point.
Oh, just listening to the details from him,
oh,
you wonder how he even survived.
I don't know. And he said he wasn't even really a fan of heights. He didn't like heights. But I guess when you're down to the wire and it's life or death, you do what you have to do. Like I said, John was not going to die easily.
No, he wasn't.
So the helicopter was destroyed.
It was blown up, and the building got set on fire.
Yeah.
From that.
Yep, big explosions. The elevator was hit from the explosion, and the wall blew out. And then John heard his wife Holly screaming. So he was able to make his way to the vault, I think by asking one of her fellow employees, have you seen Holly? But Hans was trying to get all of the bearer bonds at this point. He just wants the money and to get out of there. This wasn't going well.
Yeah, his plans were in the toilet right now.
And he's not used to that. He'd always been successful before.
Yeah, well, he was known for his meticulous planning.
Yes, he didn't usually leave anything to chance.
Yeah, things always worked, and now he's all screwed up because of John McClane.
Yeah.
So he's trying to get the bearer bonds and, you know, get what he can. John, meanwhile, found some supplies, which included some Christmas packing tape. And what he did was he taped a loaded gun between his shoulder blades.
And I think it only had 2 bullets in it.
I think you're right.
He didn't have a shot to spare, really.
And Hans was holding a gun to Holly's head. At this point, he's facing John. And he mocked John for being a cowboy. And he pointed his gun at John. But John had his hands behind his head, kind of clasped together, and he starts laughing. And people look at him like, you know, what's this? Are you nuts? What are you laughing about? You're going to die.
Yeah, Holly couldn't imagine why he was laughing.
Nope. So as Hans was laughing and the terrorist named Eddie, the guy who was the fake security guard, they're all laughing. Ho, ho, ho. John grabbed the gun from behind his back. I think actually he shot Hans first and then he shot Eddie. One or the other.
Yeah, but he did end up shooting both of them.
Yeah, but he didn't kill Hans. He hit him in the shoulder.
Yes.
So Hans fell backward out a window.
Yeah.
And he's out of the building, but he's grabbed onto Holly's wrist, and he's trying to pull her down with him or trying to pull up back into the room, whatever, just trying to get to safety.
Yes.
Outside, there's debris everywhere, and the bearer bonds were just all over the place.
Yeah, they were coming down like snow, and it's Christmas Eve.
Yep. And how did John save his wife? He unclasped the wristwatch that Hans was holding onto.
Yeah, and that was actually a Rolex that she had been given by her boss for making a good deal at work. So I don't know what that's supposed to suggest to us. It just seems, how long would that watch hold his weight?
Well, it wouldn't. It wouldn't. He'd pull her down with him.
Well, that's what I mean. But fortunately, John was able to save her from being pulled down with him.
Yeah, he unclasped the watch and Hans fell, 20 stories or something?
Yeah, can you imagine what his face must have looked like?
It's just mush.
Yeah, I meant on the way down, but yes.
Right.
It was eventually mush, sure.
So John and Holly both survive. He looks pretty much the worst for wear.
Yes.
Holly still looks pretty good. They walked out of the building together. And then someone's car radio is playing Let It Snow as they're making their way to Argyle and the limo that's waiting out front for them. And that's when John met Al in person. They hugged and had a moment.
Yeah.
And John introduced Holly to Al.
Very sweet moment. And really sweet moment for the couple who had been having problems, right?
They had been.
But all those seem to be in the past after going through all this.
Yeah, you can tell that they still love each other.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And looks like they're going to make a go of it.
Yeah, John eventually would move out to L.A. to be with her, which he should have done in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was too proudful or something.
Yeah.
But wait, we're not done yet.
No, they thought they were safe, but it wasn't over.
It wasn't. Carl wasn't dead. Remember, we left Carl.
The big blonde ex-ballet dancer.
Hanging from a bunch of chains.
Yep.
But he came out of the building. He's firing his machine gun. People are throwing themselves on the ground. And then there's Al staring him down. This is the guy who was afraid to shoot his gun anymore. He drew his gun and shot and killed Carl at that point.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then kind of an aftermath. John didn't go to the police station that night because he and Holly just wanted to go home to their kids.
And that poor nanny who'd been...
Yeah, she's traumatized.
Yeah, yeah.
So they kiss. Argyle picks them up in the limo and out they go.
Yeah. So what a night. The crime scene was examined, of course, over the following weeks. John wasn't charged with anything and he was actually decided to be a hero and actually got quite a bit of publicity, although he didn't want it. He said, I just did my job. I don't want any publicity. But it was a big story.
Well, yes, it was.
Yeah. So he and Holly were reunited. John was back in L.A. with the family after that.
Yep, he joined the LAPD.
Yeah, I think he did that in 1991, I think.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. And he decided he liked the warm weather there, even though it was an adjustment from New York.
Definitely an adjustment.
But, you know, John just seemed like the kind of guy who attracted trouble in the years that followed. He had other encounters with major criminal gangs from all over the world. And through it all, he has managed to survive. Now he's, what, in his 60s and still going strong.
Still going.
Al's wife gave birth to a baby girl not long after this incident, and the two families stay in touch. They actually get together once in a while.
Yeah, they've remained friends.
So just quite a story, but, you know, he made a friend out of it, I guess.
Yes, he did. And he survived.
Yes.
His wife survived.
Yes. But this was really something for the Nakatomi Corporation. They did lose, what, 26 people in this?
I believe.
They lost a lot of people. There. Yeah. So the building has been rebuilt, and there's a plaque honoring the people outside.
Yes.
A memorial.
It's pretty poignant.
Yeah. I mean, most of the people killed were young people. I guess the only fortunate thing is no children were invited to the party. It was just employees and spouses.
Yes, good thing.
But another bit of good news is that Holly's pregnant co-worker was absolutely fine, and she had her baby the next day. Probably this whole incident made her go into early labor.
She probably went into labor from that, yeah.
Yeah, but she was already 8 months along, so the baby was fine. A little boy, and I think she named him John, didn't she? Because John saved her life.
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah. She's a real sweetheart. Yeah, so just
wow.
Quite a crime. Quite a crime.
Quite a crime, and I'll tell you, if I didn't know the veracity of this, I would struggle to believe that this really happened.
Yeah, but there are witnesses, so it sure as hell happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there might even be some leftover CCTV footage of a few of the events.
There could be.
Yeah, although it was the 80s, so they didn't have a lot of cameras as they do today.
No.
No. Well, thanks for discussing this with me, Dick. It's quite a crime. It really teaches you that it's good to be prepared and to just keep an eye on what's going on around you, your surroundings.
But also it teaches you to maybe not be prepared, but there are oftentimes going to be emergencies or glitches.
Yes.
And you better be able to think quickly on your feet to get out of these fixes.
And I think that's one of the things that really saved John.
Oh, yeah.
Is thinking quickly on his feet and not being afraid to act, even when the actions he had to take were, let's just say, undesirable.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, he hadn't even broken a bone. He had a lot of injuries, a lot of cuts and abrasions.
Yeah.
But I don't think he had one broken bone.
Yeah, I think maybe he cracked a couple ribs from
sure.
his fight with Carl.
Sure.
But I think otherwise he came through it pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. And Holly was absolutely fine. And boy, those kids were just happy to see their parents come home on Christmas Eve.
Especially Daddy. They hadn't
yeah.
seen him for a while.
They didn't even go to bed. They just made hot cocoa and opened their presents and had a great time. Just so happy to have Dad back and Mom and Dad safe.
Yep.
Okay, so Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to all of our listeners. We were planning to take next week off, but a wonderful listener of ours sent us a story about a 1985 murder, I believe it is.
Right, 1985.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that next week.
Yeah, we hope you like it.
Yes, a little different, but really fascinating.
Very much so.
Sure. All right. Well, you know where we'll see you next time.
Quiet End.
At the Quiet End. That's right. So, bye-bye.
Bye, guys.